Thank you. So I will be talking about work done in collaboration with Goncharov, Spraden, Volovich. Mark and Anastasia are in the audience, and this is based on this paper. So we want to compute scattering amplitudes or Wilson loops as explicitly as possible, just obtain functions that you can evaluate. And I'm going to start with a bit of a review. For people who don't know what the remainder function is. Or the BDS ansatz. So on the scattering amplitude side, generically, the structure of the answer is going to be some color factor times some spin factor. This is very schematic. The spin factors are going to be, in general, some rational or algebraic functions, and they're going to be accounting for the Lorentz transformation properties of the scattering. And then we're going to have here some transcendental function, and this is where the loop expansion sits. And at L loops, let me denote this by T with an index A for amplitudes. T of A is going to have an expansion. Suppose we regularize this in dimensional regularization. This is going to be infrared divergent for n equals 4 scattering amplitudes. And this is going to start so. And in fact, it turns out if you take the log of this, you're going to get a much simpler behavior. And we're always going to work with the log of this quantity here. And pretty much the same story is true for the Wilson loops. Except that for the bosonic Wilson loop, there is no spin factor, so we're going to compute straight TW. So this would be an L loop quantity. But if we take the log, we're going to have the same behavior. Now, in general, the structure of the, and I should mention here that these are UV divergences, and these are IR divergences. Now, the structure of these divergences is known, and by subtracting this known divergent part, one can get a finite piece. So I'm going to define these finite pieces by subtracting the known UV divergences, infrared divergences in this case, and UV divergences in this case. So what we are after now are these two functions, and the Wilson loop, bosonic Wilson loop, MHV scattering amplitude correspondence tell us that these two quantities are equal. But what are they? So one way to get a handle on, or at least constrain them, is to use the conformal symmetry of the Wilson loop. And one can find an anomalous word identity for this conformal symmetry of the Wilson loop, which will constrain this quantity. And this is work done by Drummond, Korchemsky, Ten, and Sokachev. Some of the authors are in the audience. And I'm going to write for you this identity for an endpoint finite part of the Wilson loop. And the important thing here is that for 4 and 5 point, the solution is unique up to a constant, additive constant. But for higher number of points, so this here I should say, the x's are the coordinates of the vertices of the dual Wilson loop to the amplitude. So if we believe in this duality, obviously the fact that the solution is unique for the Wilson loops is going to tell us that the solution is unique for the amplitude as well. But starting at 6 point, one can, any function of the 6 point cross ratios is going to satisfy the homogeneous equation. So this word identity does not constrain the function completely. And there is a particularly nice solution to this conformal word identity, which is the BVS ansatz, which was actually proposed before before this identity was discovered. And the BVS ansatz has some very nice features. Well, first of all, it reproduces the one loop amplitudes. And it satisfies the simple collinear limits through two loops. And there is a four-point three-loop explicit check. So the BDS ansatz is a solution of this conformal word identity, but it's not the unique solution. So the question is the BDS ansatz the whole answer? And it turns out it isn't. So starting at 6 point, we have a remainder function. This remainder function is a function of three cross ratios. Which I'm going to write down. I'm going to write down in this language. So imagine this is our three, four, five, six, and U1 is x13 squared, 4, 6 squared, 3, 6 squared, 4, 1 squared, and then cyclically 1, 5, 2, 4, 1, 4, 2, 5. So we know part of the answer, and we know that there's a remainder, and the question is how to compute this.
It's multiplied by remainder function. Multiply it. It is the amplitude.
No, I'm talking about the log. I'm taking the log here. I'm taking the log. I'm always working with the log of the. Good. Any other questions?
This three looks like one. Is there a typo in the denominator?
Yeah. 2, 5. I guess 3, 6, 3, 5. 3, 5 and 2, 6. everything out, it's okay. Okay, so how to compute this? You can do it in two ways. You can start from the amplitude side, and then you're going to have to compute some very scary integrals. I'm just gonna write here the most complicated ones. So this is the basic integral, but it also has some numerator factors. Or from Wilson loops, and for the Wilson loops, you have this. This most complicated diagram to compute. So it's pretty hard, but this has actually been computed. By Del Duca, Dur, and Smirnov. And the way they did it is by evaluating the Wilson loop answer in a regular limit, in a certain kinematic limit where the whole dependence on cross ratios is preserved. And they found an answer, a very complicated answer, expressed in terms of the cross ratios and some arguments like the inverse of cross ratios, things like this. It's a 17-page result. And then there are some other quantities, which I'm going to write like this. Cyclic permutations. So this is a quadratic equation here. And I'm just going to write the discriminant for reference. Now, in particular, one comment I want to make here is that this discriminant is completely symmetric. So all of these equations that I obtain by cyclic permutations are going to have the same discriminant. And one other ingredient in their answer are the Goncharov polylogs. Now, they are defined recursively And you see, these are just, if I write the second step here, these are iterated integrals. This is very important. So their answer had also the more familiar polylogs. It had harmonic polylogs, but they all can be obtained from these as special cases. It's just a complex number. It's the upper integration variable.
What's the seed? I mean, what's the smallest?
Oh,
what do you start with?
The smallest is just, okay, sorry. Yeah, I guess you can take it to be one if you go all the way. Right, the one with no arguments.
Yeah.
It's going to be one. No, see, there's two kinds of arguments here. There's the ones before the semicolon and an extra one. Any other questions? So these are iterated integrals, but in fact, more is true. They are iterated integrals of a special kind. And that's not immediately obvious when you look at it. They are of this form. Now I have to explain. So I'm going to start with a simpler case in one variable. So I'm going to define, and then I'm going to generalize this. I'm going to where this is a notation for this is a recursive definition. So the claim is that, okay, maybe I should generalize to, so this is in one variable. And in multiple variables, you should think of having a CP space, and then you have a path going from 0 to some Z, and then you should think of that you have some differential forms of type D log R I living on this p dimensional space where R I are rational fractions with rational coefficients and then you should think as evaluating these differential forms on this path, or in more mathematical terms, computing the pullback to the path, and then evaluating the answer as in the single variable case. So if I have, I don't know, if this is not clear, I can try to explain a bit more. It's okay. Okay, so this is definitely a restricted class of iterative integrals, not the most general kind you can think of. And the claim, and this is not obvious, is that these Goncharov polylogs belong to this class. So I'm going to be able to write them as a linear combination when you try to write them that way, and I'm not going to give here the answer, it turns out the answer is pretty long. So now I'm ready to tell you what the symbol is. So if I manage to write my functions in this very special form, then the symbol is going to be symbolically written as R1 up to Rn. So when it has length n, it means it's a transcendentality n function. Now, some properties these are some pretty obvious properties. If I just have a constant in here, that's not going to be important. I can just erase it. And you can trace this back to this definition. If I just put a constant in here, that's not going to make any difference. Because of the differential, we'll kill it. And the second property is a behavior under products. And this is an additive behavior. And that can be understood easily from the properties of the logarithm function. important thing we are able to do with symbols is we can do operations. Just like we can add or multiply integrals, we can also do this. These operations have a counterpart on the symbols. So there's an obvious one. Here I'm always adding symbols of the same rank, if you wish. So this is linear. If I have this, and finally, the most complicated one is when I take a product of two functions, one of transcendentality n and the other of transcendentality m. And this is the shuffle product of the symbols of the two functions. And the shuffle product is defined is defined recursively as follows. So this is just going to give you all the ways of arranging the two sets of objects and permuting them, but only restrict to the permutations that don't change the ordering in the first and in the second sets.
The algebra of the harmonic polylogs, right?
Yes, yes. Actually, the harmonic polylogs have pretty simple symbols. Okay, so how do we compute them? So obviously one way would be you just manage to beat your integral into this form, and that's a fine way to do it, but probably the not the easiest way. So one way is if you take the total differential. So if we start with a function and here I'm integrating over a path from 0 to 1. So I remind you that this symbol here just tells you that you have an iterated integral. And then it's not too hard to show that the differential of this function So if you manage to compute the differential of the function, then you can proceed recursively and build up your symbol from the last entry to the first entry. And from this point of view, the shuffle algebra structure is just a consequence of the Leibniz identity for the derivative of a product. So that can be shown in this way. And this is not easy either. Definitely, if you have a Feynman integral, if you want to compute the differential of that function, that's not going to be easy to do. But at this point, in some sense, this is the best we have. There is a hope that this can be computed by using monodromies. So this is not developed completely. And here, I'm just going to draw a picture because I can't show you formulas. So imagine you have a space and you have your path. And then inside this space, you also have some other varieties where one of these Ri has a zero or poles. Right, so that's when things are not well defined in this definition. And then you can think of what's happening when I start deforming this integration path. Right, and you can see that I'm going to pick up some poles. And presumably, I should be able to somehow extract from this information everything I need. I mean, definitely the rational functions are determined completely by, they're determined by zeros and poles up to multiplicative factors, which don't matter anyway. So in some sense, all the information is there. All we need is a way to extract it. OK, so this hasn't been very explicit, but that's all we can do at the moment. And this actually brings me to a point, an important point, which is that a symbol does not uniquely define a function. So there can be different functions with the same symbol. And you can see here that if I choose this integration path in a different way, well, I'm going to get a different function. But that function is going to differ from the initial one by terms like pi times tn minus 1, where this is a transcendentality n minus one function. So this, well, Mark has called those sub-leading functional transcendentality. They are the same transcendentality as our function, it's transcendentality n, but the functional dependence is sub-leading. So in some sense, we have the most complicated piece we can detect with a symbol, and then there are these simpler functions that the symbol will not tell you anything about, because they correspond to ambiguities in your choice of contour or in your choice of initial point. So
it is I prime multiplied by t. I prime, not?
Yes, 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 yes. Okay. So now that I defined them, I should show you what they are good for. And one particular thing they are very good for are proving relations between functions. So these transcendental functions satisfy very complicated functional identities. And those functional identities translate to relations that can be proven by just using these two simple properties. So this is all we need. And I'm going to give you a nice example that I like very much. So I'm going to go a transcendentality two example. A transcendentality one is too trivial, so I'm not going to bother with it. So this is something that is very well known. It's the Li Tu five-term identity. And let me start with a recursion relation. This recursion relation is periodic. So the solution of this recursion relation is periodic with period 5. It's not obvious. You should try it. You start, you pick two initial values, and you keep computing. And after 5 iterations, you should come back to where you started. And here, I'm just going to give you one choice. Which is going to produce for us the five-term identity in a familiar way. So if I start with that, now let me take the symbol of the sum I from 1 to 5 of Li2 of Ai. Okay, now I should step back a little bit and tell you what the symbol of Li2 is. What is the symbol of Li2? Well, we can do it for the transcendentality n case straight away, because V n minus 1 t and V1 z so I can write this as an iterated integral let's do t1 0 t n minus 2 minus 1 tn and with a minus sign. So here I can just read off one terms. I wrote the things a bit in the opposite order than in the first definition where I was integrating, which I erased. Well, this is the result for the n. So let me go back here. And I'm going to get minus sum from 1 to 5 and now I'm going to use this relation I, and the sum is always mod 5 because this recursion relation is periodic. So this sum can be rewritten as ai plus 1 plus ai plus 1 ai. So this is a symmetric combination. Now, if I do the simplest product here of two logarithms, a logarithm has a trivial symbol, it's just the argument, right? And then I take log of x and log of y, and I do the shuffle product, well, I'm just going to get the symmetric combination of the two arguments, right? So this is equal to minus symbol of log ai, log of ai plus 1. So I've shown that the symbol of this combination V2 of AI equals 0. Okay, now I can't say that this sum here is going to be 0, and it's not. It turns out that the five-term identity is pi squared. So again, this term here, it's not going to be detected by the symbol. So that has to be obtained by different means, but already we have a pretty non-trivial piece that we have obtained just by very simple algebraic manipulations.
These relations between the polylogs and the logs, they are usually restricted to certain intervals or conditions for the variables, like okay. X and Y
good.
Cannot be in the entire range plus infinity to minus infinity, but let's say
right.
X times Y has to be smaller than 1
yes.
or bigger
yes.
than whatever.
Yes.
Does this take care of that?
This is completely insensitive to branch cuts, but when you put the branch cut information in, so that's extra information you put in, then you can constrain even more. And I'm going to give you an example later.
So at this stage, this kind of ignores the...
So let me actually give you this example right now. So let's talk about branch cuts. So I'm going to compute this. And we've seen that C is equal to that. So this is going to be the same as minus okay, so what I've done here, I've inverted all of these arguments, right? And that introduces a sign because, so I just erased the relations here, but see, I can have this. So this is going to be 0, but this is also going to be so so every time I invert something, I have an extra sign. Okay, so I've inverted n minus 1 terms. I pick up a minus to n minus 1 power, and actually this, then I can expand the factor out this term here. While neglecting a sign, because if I put everything over the same denominator, I'm going to get x minus 1 divided by x, and that's equivalent to 1 minus x in the symbol. I'm neglecting a global constant. And you see that this is equal to the symbol of minus 1 to power n minus 1 dn of x plus minus 2 power n minus 1 1 over n factorial log of x to power n. So you can actually show that this, it's not hard. This 1 over n factorial times a log x to power n, when you compute the symbol of that, just by the shuffle identity again, you get this product of all x's. So now you have this and this, and you know that the difference is going to be of sub-leading functional transcendentality, but you don't know exactly what it is. Okay, so let's try to put in information about branch cuts. So, and I'm going to go very quick here. So this is the n of x. This is the x-plane. This has a branch cut. The way it's usually defined has a branch cut starting at 1 and going to infinity. I have also, in my identity there, I have log x and this one is going to have a branch cut here, and I also have the n of 1 over x, and this is going to have a branch cut here, right? I can find this from this, and you see that if I add, how did I take it? I took the ln of x and log. So if I add this and this together, I'm not going to get this, right? So what I'm going to do instead, I'm going to take minus x . So this is not good. But if I take this, this has the same symbol. So I didn't spoil anything. And now all I have to do when I add this and this together is to cancel everything that's on this branch cut in here. Right? And that can be done explicitly because all of these discontinuities I can compute and to just powers of logs. So the final result, which I can give you, it's not that hard to get. The final result, ln of x plus equals sum k larger than 0 and minus 2k larger or equal to 0. And B and R Bernoulli numbers. There are several conventions, so I'm going to give you the first few. And then all the old ones are zero, and so on. So you can actually get this explicitly, in this case at least. So you see, you can use symbols to sort of get a general idea what kind of functions you have. Then you can start moving branch cuts around. That's pretty non-trivial in itself, but it's a powerful constraint. Okay.
What does it say? Do you have a question? Can you just read it?
It's minus 1 to power k, 1 minus 2 to power 1 minus 2k. Sorry, I should write bigger.
So by the symbology, could the other identity which you have, which is equal to pi squared?
No, so this is a constant. You're never going to get that from...
I don't know, but my question was, could it have been also a linear, I mean, just a linear term log on the right-hand side?
Sure. Sure. A priori, I mean, before you do the analysis of the branch cuts, you expect those to appear, yes.
So when two symbols are equal, you can only conclude that the difference is a function of non-leading, of something non-leading.
Yeah. So in the case we're interested in, so at two loops, we are dealing with transcendentality four functions. And obviously, in that case, you could fear that, you know, there's a lot of freedom that you, there's a lot of things that you're never going to be able to detect with this. But it turns out that just thinking about the branch cuts is very, very constraining. So, and also...
Can't you also take derivatives? I mean, you get simpler functions, no?
Well, see, the symbol is, in some sense, taking derivatives, but taking derivatives in a very smart way, because see, if you have a transcendental function, you take a derivative, you're going to get something of type d log, and then if you take the second derivative, you're going to get a rational piece as well, right? Whereas if you just eliminate this whole d log thing, then you can take a derivative again and you can recurse there. So now I should probably go back to the remainder function. And obviously, I'm not going to be able to write down for you much, because everything is too long and complicated. But I want to make an important point here. So I've told you that in the form Del Duca et al. Computed the answer, they had quadratic equations. And then I told you that the functions, that the entries of the symbol have to be rational fractions with rational coefficients. So it's clear that we are using the wrong kind of variables. We have to find variables where we get rid of these square roots. Right, and the square root is essentially just one, the one that I wrote for you. Let me write it again. And the cross ratios I defined before. And it turns out that the best way to deal with these square roots is to use the momentum twisters of Andrew Hodges. Now, I can't give here an introduction to momentum twisters, so I'm just going to be very brief. And I'm going to tell you. Just very quickly, how to deal with them. How much time do I have? Okay. So these momentum twisters are four component objects. So, Wi alpha and alpha is an index that goes from 1 to 4 and there's as many of them as particles you have, and I associate to each coordinate in space-time such a combination of objects. So I'm anti-symmetrizing here in the alpha and beta indices. And
I plus 1 on the second time?
Yes, I plus 1. So this sort of mixes neighbors, which is a bit unusual. So for now, everything I'm going to use is going to be that when writing cross ratios, I should replace the distances between points I and j squared by such an object. This is not strictly true, but the piece I'm not writing down is going to cancel in cross ratios. And there's a shorthand notation for this. This is a four bracket. And they satisfy Plucker identities, or Skouton identities if you want. Which are, if you're familiar with the spin or angle bracket, this will not surprise you. And in fact, if you have two common entries in the 2-4 bracket, then there's a, this is a 5-term identity. But if you have two common entries, then you get a 3-term identity. You know, it's a non-trivial exercise that you can do. You can take this delta. You can use the definitions of U. Do this replacement for the distances, and use the these identities, and you should find that square root of delta is plus or minus, there's an ambiguity, 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4, 5, 6, minus 2, 3, 4, 5, 4, 5, 6, 1, 6, 1, 2, 3, divided by 5, 6, 3, 4, 6, 1. This is non-trivial, but it's true. And now, if we start using these variables everywhere, then we...
Variables, you mean these brackets now?
Or? Yes, yes, sorry. So we're going to start using these brackets everywhere now.
Instead of using the
cross ratios and the U1, 2, 3, plus, minus, and everything that... everything else that was there. So you see, those variables that appeared in the result by Del Duca et al. Are very redundant, right? They satisfy a lot of identities, really. And these are redundant as well, but in this sense. Okay, so now if we use this and we compute the symbol and we express it in terms of these four brackets, then we see a massive reduction in the number of terms. It simplifies from, I don't have all the numbers, but to something much, much easier to deal with. And then once we have the symbol in this language, then obviously we want to find a function, right? And that's the first step, and then the second step, well, we want to find a function with the right symbol, and then we want to find a function with the right branch cuts as well, right? So that's not trivial, but I can give you a how to proceed, right? From so this is a hard problem, but I can give you an example in a simple case of how you can hope to approach it. So let's do transcendentality 2. Again. So suppose we start with a symbol, and then we look at the symmetric and anti-symmetric part. Now the symmetric part, if you remember the product of logs example, this is just going to give you log times log. And this is very easy to deal with. And the anti-symmetric part is going to be a mixing between Li 2 and log times log. And this is going to take the form of, it's going to be something like this. It's a combination of L of x so this is Roger's L function. If you compute the symbol of this, it's going to be anti-symmetric. So what you do at transcendentality 4, well, you do pretty much the same thing, except that now you're using more complicated projection operators to project out different pieces. So that's a very brief discussion about how to find the function with the right symbol, then you want to find the function with the right branch cuts. In particular, we want what we imposed was that the remainder function does not have any branch cuts in the Euclidean region, so where all of these distances, xij squared, are negative. And this implies that all the u's are positive. So when all the u's are positive, all the cross ratios are positive, then we don't expect any branch cuts.
Does that land you uniquely once you have the
we only found one solution that worked, and when we found it, then we stopped looking, obviously. But I'm not sure. I don't think you have a lot of freedom. Obviously, you could think about adding lower transcendentality, lower functional transcendentality pieces always, right? Which are safe in the Euclidean region. And you can do that. That's not a problem. But in some sense, the sort of the minimal thing worked, right? So Once we had a function that was real analytic in this Euclidean region, and with the right symbol, then that was pretty much the answer, up to a factor of pi to the 4 that you can get from collinear limits. So before I stop, well, what is left to do? Well, obviously, we'd like to have higher point examples.
What happened to the 17 pages?
Oh, the 17 pages. Yeah. So I didn't write down the final answer, but the final answer is pretty simple. And so one thing that's very simple about it is that it has only the most complicated function that appears in it is Li 4. So there's no trace of Goncharov polylogs left in the final answer. And the answer is pretty simple. It's actually expressed in terms of cross ratios, which would be kind of awkward to write in the language of xij squared, but it's pretty simple to write in this language. And actually, maybe I should just write one of these cross ratios just to show you. So it's natural cross ratios. And I'm going to write a general case. An analog here, and you see, if you look at this, you can see this is a distance between I and K, but the other ones are different. They don't have two neighboring objects and two other neighboring objects. So if you wanted to express this in terms of cross ratios, the initial ones, the ones that are written in terms of these distances squared, well, then you would get you would only be able to write it as a solution of a quadratic equation. Any other questions? Yes. So the final result is very short. Yes, I should have stressed that.
Get the number from him.
No, it's well.
One line.
One line. Why
is it? Well, it's cheating.
She should have written it.
Why did you write?
I should have written it before.
Why did you write it for Turing?
Well, I don't have it with me here, and I don't know it by heart.
Just write something.
Can you bring it up on your math tab and put it on the blackboard?
So, it's a, yeah, it's true. Mark is right. I should have written it on the, in a corner there.
Tell you what, I'll do it.
So yeah. So what's next? Well, obviously we'd like to do higher point, and Simon Caron has a proposal for what the remainder function at higher point, what the symbol of the remainder function at higher point should be.
You know what's been done at next MHP? Is there any?
Yes, so then we'd like to compute the ratio functions. And for the ratio functions, nothing is known at two loop, really. I mean, there are some numerical results, but. In the discussion, I presented.
The variables?
I think at 6 point, there's not much else. Well, there are other things that you can write. But these things, that these cross ratios that appeared for the MHV, have some nice properties. They have nice collinear limits. So I think it's very likely that the ratio function, at least at 6 point, should be expressible in terms of the same objects. Now it's not, and I think it's likely that it will be just usual polylogs as well. But of course we don't know. And there's now beyond the ratio functions, now we have the super Wilson loop version 2, and we have the correlation function approach. And in there are some new function appearing in the theta bar expansion. And of course, we have no idea what those are. And ultimately, we want to make contact with a strong coupling. Sure, that's definitely a dream. And at strong coupling, we are already seeing traces of these momentum twisters. They are a bit, well, they depend on wall sheet coordinates. They depend on a spectral parameter. You have a Hirota equation that they satisfy, which is actually closely related to these Plucker identities. Hopefully we will make the language agree on both sides as much as possible, and that will help to bridge the gap.
Explain a little.
Okay. So, there are several terms here. This x plus and x minus are basically those objects in there. So here, what you should do is you should use x 1 4 plus minus x 2 5 and x 3 6. Yes, so Mark wrote them x1, x2, x3, but I used two indices there to I should put I and k, right? And here, there are several pieces. I'm actually going to focus on discussing this L4 because it's probably less familiar. And it turns out that this L4, see, much of its structure is that was the hardest thing to get, and much of the structure is dictated by branch cuts. This combination here, for example, you see, this is done to make the branch cuts work out. Remember, I showed you an example, a combination of Li n of x and Li n of 1 over x, which this one is with the opposite sign. But the combination is just such that all the problems go away. Uh, And yes, it turns out that this function, but for transcendentality 3 now, you can obviously extend it for, Mark wrote it for transcendentality 4 here, but you can write this for higher transcendentality. And it turns out it has appeared in this computation of six-dimensional hexagons, and it seems to be a very nice function that makes an appearance in several places. UI, yeah, so I used the UIs are the usual cross ratios, which I erased. The three cross ratios, yes.
The Duca and company would know what other algorithms use at the beginning. We do the calculation, it would be simpler, or it would be.
I'm not sure. It definitely helps to know, but I'm not sure it would help that much. I mean,
they wouldn't know. Identities
Well, last time I talked to Del Duca, he was obviously interested in understanding these variables, and I think they are using them to get rid of square roots. See, one of the problems they had also was that the answer, the way they presented it. It's hard to make sense of the analytic structure. You have square roots inside polylogs, and I think in their paper they claimed that it's valid only inside of a unit cube in this three-dimensional U space, U1, U2, U3. So maybe one thing it would help with is just push the boundaries a little bit of the region where the answer is valid. But I think their approach the way they're computing things is does not deal with all the potential identities that you could have. So they're still,
I'm sure they're using symbols today.
Can I ask this question? In principle, it is written in Euclidean region. Yes, when
yes.
This is Euclidean
yes.
region.
Yes.
If you would, no, there are many physical regions.
Yes.
Yeah. If you analytically continue this expression in this physical region, symbols for corresponding expression will be the same.
The same. Yeah.
And therefore, in principle, you could construct amplitude from this symbol, maybe in all physical regions.
This formula there we tested in the Euclidean region, and we tested it against computations that were done, numerical computations, and we didn't test it for values outside that Euclidean region.
You think maybe the symbols maybe are not applicable to other regions?
Well, they apply everywhere. But all I'm saying is that at least personally, I haven't performed any test outside the Euclidean region, and things are more subtle outside that. So I don't know what to say.
Because in principle, again, the problem in this IPI jobs in some sense, when you analytically continue. Not
yes,
in,
yes. So well, I. Yeah, I don't see how much ambiguity there is. So once you have an answer that works in the Euclidean region, you could imagine that somehow it fails to work outside that, but. But I haven't seen any problem so far, so. So I.
This Euclidean region, the logs are from negative, I mean of negative arguments?
No, so here, this is a function only of cross ratios. And these cross ratios, the regular ones that you write in terms of differences of x squared, they're positive. But the distances themselves are negative.
I have a question to see, maybe. I mean, what is the thinking really about this remainder function? I mean, obviously, there is a case now where the conjecture has to be corrected by this extra term. I mean, is there reason to hope that there is some deep structure in this remainder, or will it just, you know?
Actually, Marcus can answer. He will tell you that you can have more things.
So you see, that I was telling you about the BDS ansatz, and the BDS ansatz takes into account the simple collinear limits, and the remainder function is going to be sensitive to higher collinear limits. And for example, the six-point remainder function is very closely related to the triple splitting amplitude. And there's actually a very nice structure here, how the remainder function behaves under collinear limits. And that has, of course, been part of also this Wilson loop OPE approach.
Maybe Perron Hewitt's work makes a clear case. He has the symbols for arbitrary numbers of legs of two loops. So it's something that can really be done. Now, people don't have the function yet, but many are working hard on that.
So you're saying R8 and R10?
Yeah, exactly. It's basically that is clearly falling under control.
This is two loops.
Yeah,
two loops. So you mean extending this to higher number of legs,
right?
They have the symbols, but not yet.
I mean, the point is that there's a regular enough pattern that Perron Hewitt would be able to write it down. But there's enough constraints that you could do it.
And there's, as Pedro was saying, there's hope that if we get the three-loop answer, then one can start using integrability to really solve the problem completely. Because we know this theory is integrable.
Fair to say, everybody who works on this believes it can be done. Otherwise, they wouldn't be working on it. So maybe that's not a profound statement. Okay. I mean, let's thank Christian for that.